This is the AI Health Podcast, where we explore the ways in which AI will transform healthcare, biotech, and medicine through conversations with entrepreneurs, investors, and scientists.
Hey, I'm your co-host, Pranav Rajpurkar.
And I'm Adrielle Saporta.
And you're listening to the AI Health Podcast. Today, we'll be speaking with Dr. Suchi Saria of Johns Hopkins University, where she is the John C. Malone Associate Professor in the Departments of Computer Science, Applied Math and Statistics, and Health Policy and Management. She's the Director of the Machine Learning and Healthcare Lab, as well as the CEO, Founder, and Chief Scientific Officer of Bayesian Health, which builds AI tools on top of electronic health record data to deliver accurate and actionable clinical signals.
Decision support tools for clinicians is a really exciting and clear use case for machine learning, but we haven't really dug into it that much on the show so far. And I feel like with a topic as huge as this, I personally find it really helpful to dive into a very specific use case to get ourselves situated a bit first.
Yeah. Let's dive into sepsis alerts. As Professor Saria will explain, it's one of her original motivations for starting Bayesian Health in the first place.
Sounds great. I don't know anything, so let's start from the very beginning.
Great. So sepsis is when the body has an overwhelming immune response to an infection or injury. Usually it's in response to a bacterial infection, but it can also happen due to a viral infection like COVID or a fungal infection or something non-infectious. Now, if it's not treated, it can lead to septic shock, in which the body's immune response triggers widespread inflammation, blood clots, and leaky blood vessels. This deprives organs of blood flow, and they can quickly fail, leading to death.
That's incredibly scary, and I can understand why it's important to build tools to catch this as quickly as possible. And who does this condition or sepsis affect most often, and like how many people per year?
Yes, so this condition affects children younger than one, as well as seniors, folks with chronic conditions, recent severe illness, weakened immune systems. Each year, 1.7 million adults in America develop sepsis, and about 270,000 die. One in three patients who die in the hospital has sepsis.
Okay, so we're talking huge numbers. And can we pivot a bit now to what sepsis alert systems look like?
Yes. So sepsis is an extremely urgent and life-threatening emergency. So alerting a medical team as quickly as possible is very important. The basic idea is to extract data contained in a patient's electronic health record to predict if they are at high risk for developing septic shock. An automated system can then alert a medical professional to review the chart and determine whether further action is required.
And how does the model make this assessment?
So basically, the model uses results of routinely collected lab measurements, vital signs and medication, procedure and clinical history. And in the case of Bayesian Health, the output is simply a binary prediction. Is this patient likely to experience septic shock?
Okay, so that sounds like a somewhat straightforward supervised machine learning problem, at least in theory. So how is Bayesian Health's model actually used in practice?
Great question. So the team released a prospective study examining the alert systems used in 5 hospitals over 2 years that has quite a good bit of detail. It hasn't been peer reviewed yet, but we don't get too many prospective studies to look at in AI and healthcare, so it's worth a look. The system was designed to alert care teams about high-risk sepsis patients while minimizing workflow interruption and alert fatigue. It visually flags patients within the EHR, but it doesn't require immediate attention. The clinician will then have the option of whether they want to address the alert or not. Think of an icon on the clinician's patients list or something like that.
Okay, and that makes sense because I imagine having an alert interrupt your normal workflow all the time would be really frustrating, especially since it won't always be right. And so what happens if the clinician decides that they do want to address the alert?
Right. So if they decide to heed the alert, then they can view summary data that contains what factors generated the alert. They can enter into the system whether or not they think the patient does indeed have sepsis. This response is, of course, super helpful for understanding algorithm performance. And then if they do think the patient has sepsis, they will presumably rearrange their priorities to treat that patient.
Got it. So what did the study actually measure?
The first thing is actual adoption rates. There are a ton of examples of clinical decision support tools not actually being used by clinicians. And so the first major thing to test isn't, is this tool accurate? It's, are clinicians actually using it? It's one of the many reasons that prospective studies like this are so much more useful than retrospective studies. They found that providers eventually evaluated 89% of sepsis alerts and 73% within the first 3 hours.
And remind me again, what does it mean to evaluate an alert?
So when a sepsis alert is triggered, the clinician has the choice of whether or not they actually want to look at that alert and see why it was generated. So this result shows that in general, clinicians didn't just ignore the alerts.
Okay. And then the important question, did using the tool actually improve patient outcomes?
So we don't have data on that yet. They did find that if clinicians evaluated and confirmed sepsis from the sepsis alert, they ordered antibiotics almost 2 hours earlier compared to when alerts were not evaluated or evaluated but dismissed.
That's interesting, but it doesn't really tell us whether the tool actually made the difference in these cases or not, right? Like maybe clinicians evaluated sepsis alerts more quickly on patients that they were already concerned about and monitoring more closely.
Well, there's certainly more work needed on the scientific side, and that's the set of important questions that the field is trying to address.
Okay. And remind me, how do Johns Hopkins, Bayesian Health, and Professor Saria relate to the story again?
So this tool was deployed in 5 hospitals that are run by Johns Hopkins, and the technology is licensed for Bayesian Health from the university.
I'm surprised that no one else has worked on something as important as this already.
Well, there certainly has been work done. So on the academic front, a review done all the way back in 2015 evaluated a number of automatic sepsis alert systems based on electronic health record data and found that they actually did not reduce mortality or length of stay. But of course, technology has advanced since then. This past June, a team of researchers evaluated a sepsis alert algorithm that was actually designed by Epic that has been used in hundreds of hospitals.
And we've talked about Epic on the show before. They're one of the major EHR systems.
Yeah, that's right. Well, this study found that this particular model was not performing well in practice. The accuracy was substantially lower than had been previously reported and was leading to quite a bit of alert fatigue, which really interferes with effective care.
Yikes. Are there any other challenges with implementing an alert system like this one?
Yeah, I think the case of COVID is an interesting one to look at too. According to one study published in November, the number of alerts from that same Epic system increased pretty dramatically at the beginning of the pandemic. And even though many of these alerts may have been accurate, they might no longer be clinically relevant given the context in which they're being used. The workflows for sepsis are generally built around bacterial infection, which is usually most common. And so if sepsis is caused as a result of a virus, clinicians may want to interact with the alerts differently, not to mention all of the workflow changes due to limited resources caused by the pandemic.
That is really interesting. You know, we talk a lot about making sure that an algorithm continues to perform well given the clinical use case that it's built for. But if the clinical context changes, either because it's deployed in a different hospital or something happens like a pandemic, the model's accuracy could, in theory, be just as good, but it could still become unhelpful.
Exactly. It's really tricky. And it's not just about having a technical solution, but also a solution that is able to manage logistically the challenges of operationalizing these AI algorithms. I'm really excited to turn the conversation over to Dr. Saria, who has spent a lot of time thinking about these exact set of challenges and get some insights.
Dr. Saria, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Very excited to be here.
I was hoping that you can maybe start by just telling us about the founding story of Bayesian Health and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, there are so many threads here. So the first is, I've been in the field of machine learning AI for about almost 20 years now, and you know, started my career in tech, got into healthcare actually around 2007-8, pre-High Tech Act. It was at Stanford. They were just starting to implement Cerner and Epic. And really a colleague of mine, neonatologist Anna Penn, said, we're collecting all these data on preemies, these babies at risk for major complications. Could we identify babies at risk for complications using data differently? And at the time, we were collecting gobs and gobs of data through bedside monitoring. We still collect, but at the time, they were being collected and thrown away 48 hours later. The question was, wouldn't there be a different lens we could provide if we could analyze this data in more detail to see if there were impeding, like, you know, early signs of deterioration? At the time, there just wasn't as much work at the intersection of ML and AI. So it was extremely illuminating for me. I have memories of sitting in the basement of Stanford trying to pull data out of Cerner. It was, let's just say, an experience. We didn't know all the things, you know, and it was early. There wasn't the same kind of infrastructure we have today. But we made a ton of discoveries. There were beautiful articles that came out of it showing the opportunity for using ML-AI to both glean and discover new patterns, but also integrate them into creating potentially actionable tools that could make care less reactive, more proactive. But one of my big discoveries then was, we're still very far away from having AI algorithms with potential use cases to actually operational infrastructure that works. And just also realizing in medicine, to bring about change, it's so much more than just the algorithms and the technology. You kind of really have to understand things end to end. Like, you have to understand the stakeholders, their pain points, conflicting priorities, reimbursement, regulation, workflow integration, IT, tech delivery, evaluation. There's just a lot of pieces to it. And to really be able to make that happen, what became really clear to me was it would be super helpful to be at a place where it would be possible to get exposure to the end-to-end. And that process, kind of fell in love with Hopkins, got recruited here as one of the first faculty between engineering and public health, and started working in both the technology front to make AIML more accessible to healthcare data sets, which are far more complex and has its own set of challenges, different from some of the challenges we've explored in other application areas of AIML, like imaging or face detection or ads, for example. And so really just started working on really foundationally contributing to how to make AIML more accessible to healthcare data sets. And this means, you know, algorithms that do better uncertainty quantification, algorithms that help with robustness, algorithms that help with reliability, as well as on the other hand, like thinking then about like, how do we put this practically, you know, how do we put this operationally into workflow? And so for that, started collaborating with system leaders to really understand where the infra is today, what the gaps are, what needs to happen. And what's been astounding is how quickly the field has moved. Like, we've made so much progress in the past 5 to 7 years. It's been amazing. All the way from like lessons coming from industry, from like big tech companies going, starting, discovering, learning, reinventing themselves, to startups, to like research has progressed rapidly. So it was at first a purely intellectual journey. And then, you know, along the way, a really unfortunate personal incident happened, which is I unfortunately lost my nephew to sepsis. And, you know, he was in India. It was not detected until it was pretty late. And it was just really heartbreaking for me to hear that, because I actually had written papers on sepsis and had written one of the earliest papers on early detection of sepsis. And what I realized was I had done all this work that made people call me, write me letters, actually saying how my work would make a huge difference. But it really wasn't actually making a difference. It was really only paving the way. But to go from like, it's possible to actually actionable is still a delta. So that was really sort of what got me to then push myself harder. You know, from my early days, I've been part of other spinouts that's come out. So I understood what it takes to build a great team and to be able to invest in, you know, building ideas that can scale nationally, internationally. And so that was the impetus, you know, partnered with incredible, incredible people like our investors, our advisors, all extremely knowledgeable people in the space to make it happen. And along the way, one of the most interesting things I've discovered is how much need there is. Like, we're at a point where there's widespread recognition there are so many use cases. There's widespread recognition that doing it well requires focused energy and is hard. It's all the way from not just the algorithm, it's really full tight integration, as I describe it often, across 9 disciplines to make this happen. And I feel like over the last few years, there's been demand from a lot of marketing. But I think as a researcher, I feel it's very important for the field to move from potential to results. And I think it's the absence of results that's been a challenge in the field. And I think emphasis on results is really another reason why I feel very passionate that like Bayesian's very focused on results-oriented work around the space.
I want to ask you about one thing you mentioned, which was that to translate potential into what actually makes a difference, you realized you had written papers, now you wanted to build this out and make a difference. I'm curious what you now see as sort of the role of academics and the role of companies in terms of making this happen. Do you see a world in which academics who are writing papers have to be the ones who then decide, okay, now I have developed enough to start a company, or are there other potential avenues which can be just as effective in terms of this translation?
I'll start by just saying something controversial, but then we'll play it out. So I think every academic should aspire to be an entrepreneur and a real change maker. And the reason I'm saying this is not because I'm expecting every academic to go out there and seek funding and start a company and learn all about marketing and sales and commercialization and all that. But what I do think is there is lots and lots of room in academia for better ways to use incredibly smart people and incredibly smart resources and putting them on the right types of problems. I think today, sometimes in an academic setting, it's just really easy to not have the full context, to know what are the gaps. Okay. On the flip side, I think academia has a very important role to play because research keeps us honest. It's extraordinarily easy, like, you know, as I'm in spending more time in industry or over the decades I've done so, I feel like it's much more unhinged. People can say things, you know, there are claims without any evidence or data supporting it. And so I think in areas like health AI, where there's really need for cutting edge, high quality ideas married to real world impact, I think you really need both. You need high quality, productive relationships between industry and researchers. So I think we can liken this all to research and computer science. When computer science first started, almost all the great work was probably happening in like either pure academic labs or like niche developer communities, right? But at some point, we needed to do reliable production at scale, at which point there were certain things that used to be part of academia then became standard industry processes. And in academia, we weren't doing research on it as much. We kind of moved on to newer topics. And so I think to some extent, I also feel this is an example area where early on in the last decade, I felt it was extremely productive to be a pure academic, really learning about the problems, the data, the challenges. But I think as we're now moving more into the operational world, to me, I find the latter set of challenges extremely interesting. But then also the crosstalk, like my work on reliability and data set drift and shift, for example, that whole line of work started 5 years ago, entirely out of our early experiences deploying solutions across hospitals and realizing the opportunity there and how little in machine learning we were paying attention to it. So, you know, some of the earliest papers on the topic actually are some examples from medicine we pulled out. And then, you know, slowly people start, it went from being an esoteric topic to something that is now a very active area of investigation.
So I'd love to dig into actually Bayesian Health, because I'd love to get a sense of how you're dealing with distribution shift and all these sort of traditional obstacles that clinician decision support tools often face. So maybe can you start by just walking us through what a traditional workflow might look like for one of your products?
Yeah, absolutely. So Bayesian offers a platform that is serves as a sleeve on top of the EMR. It makes the EMR more actionable, predictive, proactive. Today, the EMR kind of serves as a system of record, right? So as we're having care interactions, data is getting collected, data is getting stored. much of the processes are built around, you know, administrative use cases or billing. And the use of this data in care delivery is still very minimal beyond sort of obviously manual analysis. So the idea is, can we get the EMR to work for us? And so this is where what Bayesian does is puts a sleeve on top to allow the EMR to become more predictive, proactive. We're very focused on results, like I said. And this means rather than just saying a platform with no use cases, we think the use cases are very important. And so there are a number of clinical use cases we've worked on extensively. I know you've seen our work in sepsis as an example. And so we basically have models, pipes, where we pull data in real time. We've partnered with various EMR vendors to be able to do that. So we pull data in real time. We have models that run on top of it that identify patients at risk. That is then moved back into workflow in a way that is very synergistic with both the local institutional policies, but also what typical workflows look like. We spend a lot of time thinking about that. And so there are, you know, various aspects of workflow depending on the unit, the scenario, the type of patient, and also whether the institution has what kind of resources are available to them. Do they have bedside, centralized, escalation protocols? We enable all that. And for a clinician user, it's just like interacting with the EMR, except they're interacting with a slightly smarter EMR or much smarter EMR, hopefully.
One question I had relating to sepsis as a use case. So Epic had developed its sepsis algorithm, which researchers had found did not do that well in terms of causing alert fatigue. And one of the challenges with being in this space to an outsider might be Epic has all of the data, they can develop their algorithms. What role does someone who partner with Epic have to play in this process? And how do you see this playing out right now?
Yeah, excellent question. You know, I'll give you sort of where I see the field playing out. So what I feel the EMR companies have done very, very successfully is laid out infrastructure. They've helped us go as a country from paper records to electronic health infrastructure, right? Which means we've gone from, you know, daily electronic interactions being a part of everyday care. That is where all the data is kept. That's where it's centralized. So to me, I almost think of their role as the, you know, information superhighway, if I were to liken it to, you know, what we saw on the internet, which is the ability to have that infrastructure means now you can plug in things on top to enable. And, you know, because of potential, people are excited. If systems are asking for a tool, it makes sense for Epic to, you know, go in and develop something. But I haven't sensed this notion of like, you know, they're viewing themselves necessarily as the only experts in the space or as the experts in the space. So if I would have to say, you know, they have deep experience around infrastructure, software. But, you know, ML is a whole another discipline. It's a stochastic software. It's not even like typical software as a medical device, right? So it's stochastic. It has its own complexity. There's so much. The field is moving rapidly. So we see ourselves as like companies like Bayesian are extending Epic to become more productive, or extending Cerner and, you know, the EMR companies to become more productive and to create more valuable and joyous user experiences. Because at the end of the day, we're physician burnout and clinician burnout. Staffing shortages is one of the other big national issue we're dealing with. And we need the ability to create experiences that are joyful, that make it easy to practice.
I want to ask a question relating to the generalization of machine learning algorithms as they apply to EMR data. Do you think of a future in which we have to provide site-specific models where we have one model for the Mayo Clinic, one model for Stanford Health, because of our understanding that data is collected in different ways for different kinds of patients at these places? Or do you think there is a world in which you have a shared model or shared infrastructure being applied to all these places?
I think the right answer is probably both. And here's what I mean by that. You could imagine if a physician is learning, right? Clearly, when you're learning about sepsis or you're learning about cancer, you don't sort of think, because you collect the data differently, nothing about the disease processes, there's anything to be learned between Mayo and a Hopkins, you know, or Penn, right? There's still a notion of like body of clinical knowledge that we learn from data. That is site agnostic. That is more about the disease process. That's more about the type of patient, their clinical history, and in that context, what it all means. So to me, that's the 80% of the learning we have to do. And that has to be shared, because if it's not shared, we won't be able to learn fast enough. And this is really important in medicine, where a lot of places where ML can add the most amount of value are the less frequent things, right? Like the reason sepsis is often missed is because it's 2-3% of the population. It's not the thing that is top of mind for you. And sepsis is only one example. There are numerous other clinical areas of this kind. So for that, you really need the ability to learn across sites. On the flip side, you also can't have that sort of black box model approach where you come in, you have a deep rich model you've learned, but you know, historically in ML, we've sort of trained these models. We have pretty high level aggregate metrics. In medicine, it turns out because of the high dimensionality, the heterogeneity, and like the low sample case, it's just extremely easy to overfit. So you just can't learn tools that generalize if you kind of use those approaches. So I think you need to generalize, but you also need to be aware that you need techniques that can tune to individual sites. So my vision for how the field should be, and certainly how Bayesian's current take is the ability to tune to specific sites, yet have some shared common understanding of disease and disease process that we're learning across sites, which I think is necessary to succeed.
Maybe making this specific to Bayesian, what do you guys do? In the case of sepsis, for example, do you have a single model? You train it on one single data set and then deploy it to the sites that you're currently in? Or what's your approach right now at the beginning of the company's life cycle?
So in machine learning, when we refer to model, high level, the way Bayesian thinks about this is it's a collection of models that all interact. So for example, even in a given site, as we've done studies, we don't have just one, what you might hypothetically, how most users think of a model, a simple model. It really is a collection of models working in concert. And, you know, I'll wear my favorite, you know, Bayesian non-parametric lens. We think of it as open world. As you see new data coming in, you have to think about, are there new types of things you're seeing you haven't seen before, which means you have to increase model capacity. And this can come in many, many ways. It's, you know, all the way from modeling additional subpopulations, being able to tackle new types of transformations or data transformations you haven't thought about, being able to tackle specific types of shifts through either data transformations or through more robust learning algorithms you hadn't thought about. So I kind of think of it as every time we see new data, it's always adding to the improved collective knowledge of new strategies for improving the robustness, reliability, and generalizability of the models. And then for any given site, it's actually exploiting a subset. You know, for a given example, it's exploiting a subset of the models that exist.
So you have a suite of models, you're saying, for a given predictive task.
Exactly. Like even for sepsis, we have a collection of models that are tuned to subpopulations, tuned to context. And any given case doesn't rely on output from a single model. It's really a collection of models that are informing the outputs.
So does that mean then that, for example, for the true study that you guys put out, you train on a data set that you already have access to, make the model as generalizable as possible, then fine tune it to specific subpopulations. And then depending on the patient subpopulation, you're applying a specific model in that one case?
Not one model, but a collection of models. So it's like, think of it like in machine learning, we call about mixture of experts, right? Like a single person is not just one challenge. There could be three things. They could be frail, maybe they have diabetes or, you know, heart condition. Like there are specific subpopulations like stroke. It's very easy to confuse stroke and septic cases. It's extremely easy to confuse cases of patients with GI bleed and sepsis. So if you want to start like narrowing down on specific, more complex patients, you need the ability to have more complex longitudinal decision-making. And so that's where the subspecialization helps. But a given patient may not just be a GI bleed case, right? It could be a GI bleed plus alcohol, you know, substance abuse plus something else. And so a collection of models come into play. Stepping back a little bit, how do we learn? So when we first started, we started with a limited data set of a small number of hospitals. But then as we went to additional hospitals, we learned a lot from the delta that came and understood what generalization means. So that was really sort of also very much what fueled a lot of the papers we've written in this space, which is the need for generalization. What we've done is we've gone from like a small core to as we expanded. And then in some of our deployment studies, the way we pursued it is we start with the core, which is already high quality from all the data we've done. But every time you go to a new site, we do burn-in. Like, so we basically are using the data to tune, to get to a place of like making sure we really are accounting for site-specific variations. We also have lots of checks and balances in place. Some are quantitative, others are qualitative, others are human in the loop for, you know, doing QA there, like really understanding that it's working, you know, the way you expect. And a large part of it is like knowing what to expect. I think historically, one of the challenges has been in research, when we're not thinking operational, we don't lay out as much groundwork in what to expect. And so that helps.
Do you envision, you've deployed this model to a given site, do you envision every 6 months sort of needing to constantly retune or fine tune your models accordingly and sort of have systems in place to be able to do that?
In the deployments we've done, like we have QA processes in place where we, in an ongoing way, evaluate. And we borrow a lot of great tricks and tips for doing this from software engineering, right? Where we have the ability to auto detect cases and escalate and create protocols for follow up, right? Just like we have workflows for our physicians, we have workflows internally for escalation, where we get to then monitor, do human in the loop investigation. So we have many, many forms of input and feedback that come in, but that then informs what is it that we are concerned about. And then that really triggers when to re-update, right? And what form? Because really there's not like a button, model, learn, relearn. There are so many different levers when you start working operationally or ways working backward to what's the root cause and to figure out the fix and then putting that in place. And I kind of view that as ongoing. And that's what our experience has been. If there are big shifts, like, you know, COVID was a big shift. So, you know, we definitely did tuning around the deployments we had around COVID, for example.
So this sounds like quite a bit of work on a site per site basis. And generally, you know, if I'm an investor, if I'm A16Z, I usually look at companies that can scale really easily. And this doesn't sound super scalable. And so I'm curious how you think about that. Is there a vision in your mind where right now it's not scalable, but maybe in 2 years it will be? From putting your business hat on for a second, how do you think about that?
Right now, everything we're doing at the moment is to make sure we succeed in getting results. And it's very intentionally designed this way because I think all too often in academia, we generalize before we know how to solve the concrete. And I'm a big believer in let's solve the concrete, then generalize. So I feel over the last few years, what's been really fun is really getting a much more tangible understanding of the concrete. Like what frequency, what are the types of levers, what are the common use cases, what are the type of escalation patterns. Long-term, I see this just getting generalized fully into a, you know, semi-automated process where like a lot of it is automatically triaged. We've written papers on identifying issues proactively. Like one we wrote last year at the New England Journal of Medicine was laying out a table where we said, here are the different types of shifts and here are some detection methods. That is how Bayesian approaches it. We think of it as a system. You know, it's a semi-structured, semi-automated process. And we have to start categorizing and understanding different areas and then systematize it to make it as effective and efficient and then have repeatable tools.
One of the challenges beyond the technical that a lot of startups face when trying to scale and expand nationally is establishing relationships with lots of different hospitals, convincing them that this product adds value. I want to ask you about what you're proud of in terms of what you've done at Bayesian Health that allows you to scale effectively in terms of the non-technical aspects of the scaling. I'm sure there are learnings along the way that you've had that allow you to do it differently, better than when you first started out or differently than maybe other startups approach this. I'd be curious what those learnings are.
So the first most important is like, what is the altitude at which you're looking to solve the problem, right? So, you know, as a researcher, many times you're thinking about a very narrow use case where you're focused on an aspect of that use case. And that is the perspective from which every researcher starts, including myself. As I'd interacted with C-suite leaders more around like operational challenges, clinical challenges, financial considerations, maintenance considerations, then you start realizing like you really need like a bigger view of the problem, right? Who are the stakeholders? What are the problems? And to be able to problem solve, you need empathy. Like you can't come from a place of, I hardly know you. I hardly understand what your concerns are, but I think I can solve a problem for you. So I think to me, one of my biggest learnings was over the last few years has been as I've more deeply delved in the world of operations and really deploying things in practice and really getting results and seeing it, you know, from an administrative mindset where their head's at, it's just become easier and easier to understand like what the pain points and what are the real places to be solving problems. And I see hunger and appetite everywhere. Like, I don't think our challenge is the hunger or appetite for it. I think there are two frequent challenges we have to tackle. One is miseducation. So over the last 5 to 10 years, you know, the media has oriented them one way or the other. Either way, there's been a lot of excitement around AI, but there's also been a lot of like lack of clear thinking around, you know, what is it going to take? Like, where does it work? Why does it work? What is unlikely to work? Those kinds of things. Because of that lack of clear thinking, there's like miseducation. Either they are scared or they may have ideas, but they're too overconfident. So that's one big area that I often feel we have to tackle. And then the second big area is like, really clearly showing results, because you have to start from a place of not trying to conquer and boil the ocean. Like, so Bayesian by construction, our approach is very much not a point solution, but like thinking, you know, more broadly as a, you know, a platform than multiple use cases, right? So for us, very naturally, there's a temptation constantly as provider systems approach us to say, what about this use case? What about that use case? What about that use case? And I think you need real experience to be able to put a strategy behind it. And that has really helped us. Like, what we are often finding ourselves also doing is partnering with systems to help them think through strategy, because I think they have a lot of ideas in their head, but they don't have enough understanding of like, should I be doing this first or that first? Or is this hard? Is this doable? Because a lot of times people have come in, made promises without deeply understanding, and then they're not delivering, right? So that's just human like hours wasted.
You mentioned pain points as being one of the things you're addressing. In healthcare, often there is this disconnect between pain points and who's paying for a solution. And one of the challenges startups have to face is finding alignment in terms of solving a pain point and convincing a stakeholder that what I'm doing is something that allows me to charge this much for a product. How did you go about finding that alignment between solving a pain point and saying, here's my revenue model?
Three pieces. So step one is a very clear understanding of the problem you're solving, the key types of stakeholders involved, and deep empathy with each of those personas to understand kind of where the gaps are and how are we seeking to address it. So then the second thing you have to do is to then construct a ROI. This is, I think, where my, like the reimbursement hat really helps us. We really think hard about like reimbursements are completely different. If you're in a system that is very heavy on value-based contracts versus someone, a system that has a whole lot more fee for service because they're in a city that is just generally affluent, for example, you'll see totally different types of considerations. So you take that into account to write out very clearly for each use case, like a whole ROI to think through, you know, what are the components, all the different levers that matter in their scenario, like, you know, a geography and locale specific model for a specific clinical area that we're tackling. And then third, aligning on metrics for success. So we understand the pain points, we understand the ROI, then we have to understand like, okay, this is the value we're creating. This is a very measurable way in which we can, you know, measure value and the ROI that's going to come out of it. We all think it's fair. We all think it's good. It's a partnership. Now let's go win together. And that means like real measurable results.
You said stakeholders, ROI, and then metrics of success. Can you maybe give an example of one of Bayesian's products and maybe what the stakeholders are? What does the ROI sort of look like? You know, not having to get into specifics. And then what are the metrics of success?
Sure. So like, let's come back to sepsis as an example. So stakeholders are leaders in quality who care about the actual outcome improving, leaders who are clinical, who care about, you know, everyday practice. So there's frontline physicians. It could depend on ED, hospitalists, intensivists. If you're doing community care based as well, then you have to include all those. If you're an academic hospital or teaching hospital, then you have to think also about whether they're residents and fellows who are part of the program. But high level, you can put them under the frontline physician persona. Then there is the frontline nursing persona. Then there could be, in some use cases, in sepsis, it doesn't matter as much. There could be like case management, for example, right? So there's frontline nursing, frontline physicians, there's quality, and there's clinical administrative, right? So those are sort of the four that interact daily around sepsis in some way. So you want to think through who are these four stakeholders, and on a daily basis, as they interact with you, what are the challenges they're facing? Now, of course, then there's to make the bigger use case, you also have to do finance, technical, and I'm leaving those aside for now because that's sort of not on a regular day-to-day basis, more, but more like overall and like periodic reporting. And in this example, there's like in sepsis, it's actually pretty interesting. There are so many different levers all the way from early identification significantly reduces downstream, you know, like you can change the patient trajectory, which allows you to reduce length of stay, ICU utilization, reduce risk of readmission. They're one of the most expensive sources of readmission, reduce malpractice lawsuit claims. It's one of the big areas where there's a huge, massive lawsuits. So we've done ROI models where we show even in a single facility, like very significant, like several million dollar benefit just from tackling sepsis alone properly.
Thanks, Suchi. This has been wonderful. We have time for one final question, and I've been refraining asking you whether you're a frequentist or a Bayesian, but I'm going to ask as our final question here, what was or what is something about the way that you're leading Bayesian Health that you think most people would be surprised by in terms of the opinion they hold of machine learning in healthcare?
I don't know if they'd be surprised by it, but I think the way we think about it at Bayesian, that's a very important part of our DNA, is we're scientists, we're truth seekers. We want to solve the problem of improving quality and using data to really drive innovation in care discovery that, you know, improves patient outcomes, but really quadruple aim, right? Like we're improving patient outcomes, we're improving clinician experience, we're improving and cutting unnecessary waste. So in doing so, it's really, really important that we stay focused on end-to-end thinking, results. End-to-end thinking, results. And so I feel like, scientists, truth seekers, we're continuously looking for, you know, we have an end-to-end way of thinking around this and people, platform, technology, and process to enable it. We think it's possible to do it at scale across many different areas. I think 10 years from now, it'd be shame on us if we don't look back and say, I can't believe we were operating in the way we did back in 2020. Like, you know, we have the data, we have the infra. Now it's that layer on top that makes it all work together to make it effective, efficient, proactive, and easy.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being with us on the show today, Suchi.
Absolutely.
And that's all, folks. A big thank you to Dr. Saria for joining us today. And thank you for listening. We're your co-host, Pranav and Atrial, and until next time, stay safe and stay healthy.
The AI Health Podcast is produced and edited by Oishi Banerjee and Mark Robbins. Music by Ethan A. Chi. If you like what you just heard, let a friend know. Subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, or connect with us on Twitter at AI Health Podcast.